This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachel. It is probably one of the best-known works in American music. George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue premiered in 1924, though it almost didn't. Legend has it Gershwin forgot about a promise he made to write the piece for a show by bandleader Paul Whiteman. Gershwin reads about it in the newspaper and then rushes to meet the deadline. The North Carolina Symphony will be performing Gershwin's composition this week under guest conductor Edwin Outwater and featuring the pianist and composer Timo Andrus. Edwin Outwater is here with us to talk about Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue and new music performed this week by the North Carolina Symphony. Welcome to The State of Things. Good to have you here.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Tell us more about the origins of Rhapsody in Blue.
Well, you know, we hear it so often in such comforting circumstances, but it was part of a huge concert in 1924 at the Aeolian Hall in New York called An Experiment in Modern Music. And it was an attempt to combine jazz music and classical music and all sorts of other experiments. And this obviously was the standout piece. But it was a very long and quite an academic concert. And I think in many ways, the music is quite shocking, you know, when you hear how it sounded in 1924. And it still retains its punch.
Great story about that concert. I mean, long and academic in like 3 hours or so, right?
Exactly. So it was definitely breaking new ground. We know, you know, in our minds that Gershwin created this kind of fusion of jazz and classical in his concert pieces. But this kind of going back and putting yourself in those shoes and sitting there for 3 hours and listening to maybe bad experiments in jazz and classical and then coming upon this piece must have been an amazing
And this
feeling.
Was kind of at the end, right?
It
at
was.
The end of the program.
And I think they played Pomp and Circumstance after it. A very strange concert.
So the people, so tell me what happened, because the people who hung out, everybody who endured, remember, no air conditioning, kind of it's in the middle of summer. The people who hung out, were they ready to go? Were they able to appreciate it?
I think definitely kind of the cognoscenti were in the audience. I know Rachmaninoff was listening to this. John Philip Sousa was in the audience. And a lot of people who were looking for new things. So, yes, it was kind of an avant-garde audience actually listening.
Who was Gershwin in 1924?
He was a star of Tin Pan Alley and all of this, you know, kind of entertainment. And I think he had aspirations to be a more serious composer. Yeah. He went to study with Schoenberg, and Schoenberg said, I'd only make you a second-rate Schoenberg, and you're a first-rate Gershwin. So, but he did manage to create this incredible, these concert pieces, American in Paris, Rhapsody in Blue, of course, and Porgy and Bess, an opera, which is still performed in opera houses. And he died, you know, 2 years at 38. Mozart died at 36. And had he lived and continued to go in this direction, he probably would have completely changed the face of music as we know it, even more than he already did.
Well, even more than he did. I mean, to a certain extent, he did. You talked about this particular concert where the piece premiered as being an experiment in modern music. That was the title of the show itself. How self-conscious was this piece? I mean, how much was Gershwin trying to deliberately fuse as many genres as he could?
It was completely deliberate, I think. It was not just something that came out of his head. I mean, it came very naturally to him, as he said, when he wrote it. But this was a statement, you know. Yeah. And in fact, combining these two forms of music, which was not only happening with Gershwin, but with other people, was a very important statement at that time. And it was almost a political statement by doing it.
A political statement which leads you to the sort of ideas of didactic music. I mean, the idea that he's trying so hard, and yet it's a beautiful piece and it holds up for so long. It's shocking to think that any deliberate experiment that's going to be a political statement could actually be a wonderful piece of music that endures.
But that was always the case. I mean, with Mozart or Beethoven, I mean, Beethoven was making revolutionary statements in music. It happened to be beautiful music. Mozart in his operas was making statements about class and rich versus the poor, and you know that all was there, but you can do it in music too. So there was definitely precedent for that.
So there is a version of this piece, Rhapsody in Blue, that is forever etched in our ears, perhaps thanks in no small part to United Airlines. But this piece was different, especially we don't know what had happened in 1924, what that sounded like. But what we think is the original recording was made in 1928. We have a Library of Congress version of that first recording. I wonder if you can walk us through it. And before before we even start, we're not going to hear a clarinet when it starts, right? We're going to hear a piano, and it's a very different beginning in some ways.
Yeah. Well, we're actually in the piece at this point, and after the clarinet plays. And what is amazing to me is when you hear, this is Gershwin himself playing, and you hear what sounds to me like Debussy, very European kind of figurations at the beginning.
All right, let's hit it.
This could be a Debussy prelude right here. These kind of whole tony scales, very French. And then we're in a ragtime kind of feel. Now we know it's American.
Right.
But you hear that European influence before. It could have, if you had taken that, it could have been anything.
Right. How much of that music, we'll keep this in just a little bit, is typical of Gershwin? Does he fuse this in a lot of his popular music?
Constantly. Or? I mean, he obviously was very familiar with European harmony, what other people like Rachmaninoff and, you know, Debussy were doing. And like a lot of composers, he wanted to combine it with, you know, the music that surrounded him in New York. Yeah.
So here we go. And pretty soon now we're going to get to the bring in the band.
Here comes the United Airlines tune in 1928. Which is not as lush as we remember it, but very jazzy and very raw in a way. And I think people don't know how raw this music actually was at the time. And in fact, it's the piano part that sounds so calm and European. But when the band comes in, Paul Whiteman band, it's a totally different thing. And so you hear the kind of shock of that contrast there.
So this would make the academics happy. There's something new and interesting here. Was it popular when it first hit?
I think it made a huge impression, yeah, right away. I mean, it got mixed reviews, and as any revolutionary piece will, but obviously it caught on.
So what are you going to do now? You're in town to conduct the North Carolina Symphony January 8th, 9th, and 10th. Talk a little bit about what we can expect. And again, with this piece, now we've heard it so much, you know, what do you do as a conductor to make it fresh to our ears?
Well, it depends on who's playing. You have to have a good partner on the piano. And we have a very interesting and compelling partner, Timo Andrus, who's playing the piano part in Rhapsody in Blue. He is also a composer himself and will not only be playing Gershwin's piece for piano and orchestra, Rhapsody in Blue, but also his own piece for piano and orchestra, Old Keys, on the second half. So he's playing the role that Gershwin would have played as composer, pianist. And increasingly, kind of in the 21st century, there are many more composers who are playing and kind of part of the making of music and aren't just kind of academic as some of the composers in the last period were.
Did we? I'm going to sort of describe for you a kind of evolution of music through the 20th century, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but that in some ways serious music compositions became sort of sidetracked and maybe more academic, lost to us, and popular music kind of went off on its own. And are they now coming together? I mean, first of all, was that evolution anywhere near accurate? And are things coming together a little better now?
I think that's fair to say that from Schoenberg on, kind of avant-garde music became the mainstream of new music, and the experimental phase lasted through much of the 21st century. How far can we take things? Of course, this was happening in visual art and in literature with Joyce and folks like that.
Right.
But in music, it kind of took over more than in any other art form. And I think around the end of the 60s, with all that upheaval, composers, you know, like Steve Reich and John Adams, you know, started to emerge, Adams a bit later. And now, to me, classical music seems to be more natural in the way it processes what is going on in the world, that the composers are players, as I mentioned. Music is reflective of the world we live in all sorts of ways. Sometimes the use of electronics, sometimes the use of popular idioms that we hear now, but done with great artistry still. So it seems like we're kind of in a very exciting new era, which is kind of a return to the way music was written, you know, for hundreds of years, which is taking the world around us and making these sounds into serious music, into art, but not kind of ignoring what we're hearing as we go through the day.
And perhaps art, not art for its own sake, and that might be too harsh a judgment to make, but it's possible that that's a little bit about what's going on. I mean, I'm thinking about at the turn of the 20th century, if you think about modern music, atonal music comes to mind instantly, but in some ways it grabbed the headlines owing to the fact that it was so shocking and new. And I guess we have to remember that people like Gershwin were writing very melodic stuff and yet new. And
other composers were too. And some of the more melodic composers like Rachmaninoff or Sibelius or Benjamin Britten were kind of looked down upon for doing that. But what's interesting is the kind of the revolutionary composers at the turn of the 20th century, Schoenberg, Stravinsky, both felt themselves part of a tradition of music. Schoenberg, part of the Germanic Viennese tradition. Stravinsky, who said a revolution is a circle, it's a return to things that have come before, and he was obsessed with old music up to the very end. And so I think, you know, maybe people went in different directions with the revolutionary aspect of these composers. But to me, it seems basically we live in an age of not only atonal music, which is still out there, and there's still a lot of great, you know, experimental music. But we live in an age in all sorts of ways of diversity, of little gardens of music that sound different. So we miss this kind of sweeping movement, you know, of music that we felt maybe even as recently as the late 60s kind of. But right now we have this kind of incredible heterogeneous kind of world where people can listen to anything, and all sorts of music is combining and popping up in unusual and unexpected ways.
Well, that's interesting, too, that the experiment modern music had to be held in a music hall in New York City for you to hear that 3 hours of experimental music. Now it's widely available, all kinds of experimental music. So what impact is that having on composition?
I think, you know, it's kind of an obvious one. Music is available to us now in a way that it has never been, that we can hear everything. And so you have a much more eclectic listener, you have a much more eclectic composer, a much more eclectic musician who's comfortable in all sorts of different styles, because, frankly, it's easier to explore now.
Yeah. Well, you told that story about Schoenberg and Gershwin, Gershwin wanting to be the next Schoenberg, and Schoenberg saying, I could only make you second rate. But there's another story as well about their relationship and sort of Schoenberg's recognition of the popularity of Gershwin's music.
Gershwin, I mean, they were tennis partners. And Gershwin, I mean, Schoenberg admired Gershwin. Gershwin passed away, and there's beautiful audio of Schoenberg talking about Gershwin as a great composer who lived and breathed music, and that music came naturally. So, you know, a lot of these divisions and conflicts, you know, among genres of music were set up not by musicians. Mm-hmm. And even back in those days where the lines were drawn perhaps a little bit more strongly, the musicians recognized greatness in each other. And I think that's always been the case.
Did you say something like, did Schoenberg ask Gershwin how much he made?
That might be an anecdote. We don't know if it's true, but they say
we tell only apocryphal stories.
Yes, it's true.
We strive to be accurate on this show.
Yeah, and if perhaps Schoenberg should have studied with Gershwin, right?
Well, so tell us what else is on the program, because there's another composition, Jam on Toast, by a young composer that we should know more about.
That'll close the concert. Young composer Derek Brummell, who's a fantastic clarinetist and composer, and he wrote this piece for himself, but it will be played by the North Carolina Symphony's own Andrew Lowy. And it is very Gershwin-like, and it takes some heavy funk and jazz and all sorts of things and combines it into this kind of wild classical slash rock slash funk slash jazz fantasy that is quite a piece of work, which closes the concert. And also Tim O will be playing his own piece. And we're playing a piece by another young composer, Mason Bates, who wrote a piece called Rusty Air in Carolina, which uses electronics, and you hear like cicadas and things like that mixed in with some very tasty and wonderful music. And I hope you guys can come out. It's interesting to hear Gershwin with these composers, because they're in many ways the heirs to Gershwin and are doing many of the same things of Gershwin. They're writing some really appealing and interesting and provocative, but also very beautiful, melodic and exciting music.
Is there a genealogy? Do young composers pull from Gershwin still?
they all do, whether they admit it or not.
Well, I tell you what, we're going to go out on Jam on Toast by Derek Brummell, which you will hear performed by the North Carolina Symphony January 8th through the 10th. My guest is Edwin Outwater. He is the music director of the Kitchener-Waterloo Symphony in Ontario, Canada, and he will be the guest conductor for Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue and other pieces January 8th through the 10th. Edwin is also going to be speaking at 7 o'clock Quail Ridge Books about George Gershwin and Rhapsody in Blue. That's tonight at Quail Ridge Books, 7 o'clock. Thanks for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Al Wadarski helped out today. And once again, we'll hear Jam on Toast. Thank you.